Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
They say you should never meet your heroes, but I was certainly not disappointed in 2003 when I first met the theoretical physicist Steven Weinberg, whom I and many colleagues had long held in awe. The intellectual breadth, the analytical power, the lucidity, and even the ready wit. Even from a distance, they were something to behold. Up close, well, that was something else. Weinberg is unarguably one of the leading architects of the Standard Model of Fundamental Particles, which describes the forces responsible for shaping atoms. He was also a virtuoso theorist of gravity, and no one did more in the 70s and 80s to bring together astronomy and particle physics into a unified subject, astro-particle physics, as it's sometimes known. Whenever a topic in fundamental physics was being discussed, everyone wanted to know Weinberg's views on it. I remember once hearing a conference rapporteur in the early 1980s say that we all ought to take an apparently wild new idea very seriously, simply because Weinberg was pushing it. My name is Graham Farmlow, and I'm the author of The Universe Speaks in Numbers, about the relationship between pure mathematics and the search for the fundamental laws of nature. When I was researching the book, I was eager to hear Weinberg's views on this subject, especially as he's one of the theoreticians who often stresses that for him, mathematics is a tool, and that his interest is mainly in accounting for the real world. I visited him in his office at the University of Texas at Austin on a gorgeous fall day in 2014. Weinberg mentioned to me that the playwright Tom Stoppard had wanted to see that room, wondering what a typical theoretical physicist's office looks like. But this was certainly not the office of a typical theoretician. It was festooned with certificates, awards, and photos of Weinberg with various dignitaries. And there were dozens of copies of his books, including his classic texts on quantum theory, relativity, and cosmology, and others he'd written for non-specialists. I wanted to ask Weinberg about his attitude to advanced mathematics and about those wonderful times in the 60s and 70s when he, Sheldon Glashow and Adda Salam developed a type of theory known as a gauge theory that brought together the electromagnetic and weak forces under a common framework. Weinberg and others also developed a gauge theory of the strong force that acts on the quarks and gluons that exist, for example, in protons and neutrons. Both examples of subatomic particles the physicists call hadrons. Together, these gauge theories comprise the Standard Model, one of the greatest collective scientific achievements of the long 20th century, which had begun in the late 1890s with the discovery of the electron and ended with the first observation of the Higgs boson in 2012, 2 years before this interview. I began by asking Weinberg how he first became interested in science.
Well, science started for me as a toy. I was given a chemistry set as a hand-me-down from an older cousin who had lost his interest in chemistry and went instead into prize fighting. And playing with chemicals, I was led to read about chemistry, and I learned that one could understand why chemical reactions work the way they do if you knew a branch of physics called quantum mechanics. And by the time I was in high school, I was reading popular books like James Jean's The Mysterious Universe.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, I didn't learn quantum mechanics from that. But in fact, rather the opposite. I learned that it was something very esoteric and mysterious, and that I found very attractive. I thought if I understood quantum mechanics, then I would know much more than the other kids on my block.
You must have been a pretty unusual student.
I went to the Bronx High School of Science, which was at that time not a particularly good school, although it had a great reputation. For example, it didn't offer a course in calculus. Of course, in those days, not many high schools did, but you would think that a high school that supposedly provided advanced education in science and mathematics would, but it didn't. So I and a number of other people, students in the same school, including two who became physicists, Gary Feinberg and Sheldon Glashow, we all set out to learn calculus on our own. I would not say that I was particularly gifted mathematically. I'm, better, I suppose, than the average high school student, but not spectacular in mathematics. I've known people who were, but
you knew some people there who you thought were at your level.
I mean, we competed with each other. I mean, if we had all at a certain point learned calculus, and then the thing was who could go on and learn differential equations. In a way, it was a very good high school for us because it was cool to learn science and mathematics on your own. And your position among your fellows was helped by that sort of thing. Whereas in another high school, it would only have been basketball something like that would have made the difference. So the atmosphere was very good, even though the school wasn't. I had a terrific course in chemistry there, a miserable course in physics, but we were all learning physics on our own anyway.
Yeah.
There are people who were spectacular wunderkinds. I think Murray Gell-Mann probably qualifies as that.
Well, he wasn't there, was he?
Oh, no. But Murray went to Yale at some ridiculously early age. Mm. I was not that kind of prodigy.
Okay. There aren't many, actually, are there? Who really make it big.
Yeah, I don't think that being a prodigy in the sense like John Stuart Mill, being able to read and write Latin at the age of four or whatever it was, I don't think that's really so important. Murray Gell-Mann certainly has done very well, but there are a lot of other people who didn't have that experience, but still. Mm. There are other qualities that are more important, a kind of aggressiveness toward problems that goes beyond learning but pushes you to try to tear understanding from nature that I think is more important.
Can I just ask, just for a second, that comment intrigues me. This is the big picture now. Would you say that that was more important to you than some sense of ambition? Do you think it is specific to wanting to gnaw away at a problem than, say, wanting to make a place in the world?
Oh, well, they went together.
Okay.
I don't know how to, in fact, how to separate them.
Fair enough.
Well, of course, at first I wasn't doing anything original, but I loved the ability to calculate things. I remember when I calculated the shape of the cables in a suspension bridge, a typical sort of problem, getting the equation for a catenary.
Yeah.
I mean, it was thrilling to me that I was able to do that. On the other hand, I certainly didn't want to spend the rest of my life having fun solving problems. I wanted to make a name for myself, as, you know, fame, what is that line? Fame is the spur that the proud spirit doth heed. Milton.
Well, I don't know that, but it's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
Well, that's always been true for me.
Going back to those cables, because that's such a nice line here. Were you talking about the shape of the cables or the, okay, so the catenary shape of the, I see. Okay. I must say it's funny at a much more modest level.
It took me a long time, to feel that I was able to do anything creative because I was under the illusion, which I think has been a very bad thing for many people, that you can't do anything new unless you understand everything that's already been done. I was saved from that by, after graduating Cornell as an undergraduate, I had done nothing. I had not even dreamed at Cornell of doing anything then that would be original. I got married, and my wife and I decided we would love to spend our first year abroad. Neither of us had ever been in Europe.
You went to Copenhagen, didn't you?
Yes, I went to Copenhagen, and I arrived with a bag full of books, some of them obsolete. I didn't know that. And I thought I would spend the year reading and learning more theoretical physics. And after I'd been there just a few weeks, someone asked me, well, what research are you doing? And my reaction was one of horror. And I said, what are you kidding? I can't do original research. I don't know everything. And the Bohr Institute wasn't so much an educational institution as a research institution. And they said, oh, no, everyone here is doing original research. You have to do something. And so they took me in hand. And one professor, David Frisch, who was visiting from MIT, suggested a problem to me in alpha decay. And I never really understood what the problem was. And I tried to learn something about alpha decay. It was going nowhere. So I went to another professor, Gunnar Kjellén. Do you know how to spell it? K-A-L-L-E-N. It's a Swedish name.
Oh, yes, I do know that name. Yes.
And I said, do you have a problem for me that I could work on? And he said, yes. There's this guy at Columbia, T.D. Lee, who has written about something we call the Lee model, and he's saying things about it that I don't believe, and you should work and see if you can see what's wrong with the model. So I did, and I actually knew enough to be able to solve that, and I wrote a paper which was published in PhysRev Letters, the least frequently cited paper I've ever written, and it's called NV Potential in the Lee Model. But by the time I got to Princeton, where I was going to complete my PhD, I already felt like a grown-up. I was not any longer in the student groove. I was thinking of myself as a research physicist already. I was saved, in fact, from maybe years of careful study before I would actually start research by the experience at Copenhagen. So there really is a good moral there to jump in and start doing original work even if you don't know everything. And that sense of confidence that I could go into an area of physics about which I knew little and learn enough as I went so that I could make an original contribution. Although in the case of this paper, a contribution of almost vanishingly small significance, But that I never lost that. And I had learned it fairly early because of the year at Copenhagen.
I've often read and heard you say that you consider yourself very much a physicist and that mathematics for you is secondary. Important, but secondary. Okay. That's always been the case?
Yes. Right. I've never thought of myself as a mathematician. Intercollegiate mathematics competition called the William Lowell Putnam competition every year in America. And the year I was in my senior year at Cornell, I was on the team that won that competition. But there were three people on the team. One of them won high honors in his own right. I merely got an honorable mention. And the third one, who got no honors at all, no individual honors at all, he became a leading mathematician at MIT.
Oh, wow.
Daniel Kleitman.
Oh, yes. I know that name. Yeah. My goodness.
Now, he didn't do as well as I did. And I didn't do as well as the as the guy who really took personal honors.
All right. Okay. Now, one thing that I'm really keen to hear your views on, because I've never understood your views on this, so it's a good opportunity for me to understand them, is your attitude to mathematical rigor. Now, I'm going to say something that I don't understand, so please correct me. I believe I've heard you say that mathematical rigor is for other people. It's not for physicists.
Well,
please correct that. I must have misheard you.
I wouldn't say it that boldly, but, you know, this. I've written about this recently. I have a book coming out called To Explain the World. It's a history of physics and astronomy from Thales to Newton.
All right.
And one of the persistent themes has been the relation between mathematics and science.
Ooh.
And the what I call, on one hand, a tragic cleavage between them. Many natural philosophers in ancient times and in the Middle Ages distinguish between mathematics, which is used, for example, to study quantitatively the motions of the planets, and physics, which is intended to understand the planets and why they are the way they are. And that cleavage was really, well, we know it's all wrong, that finally, and in fact, Kepler emphasized this when he used the word physics in one of his books, I think in Astronomia Nova, physics is indissolubly mixed with mathematics, and mathematics is essential, as Feynman has emphasized, not only in solving problems, but in even formulating the physical principles. On the other hand, physics is not mathematics. The idea of Plato, that we're going to learn about the world just by pure thought, the way we learn about geometry by pure thought, is simply wrong. And
May I ask you, that's intriguing to me. You say that Platonic view is wrong in your view.
Yeah, completely wrong. And in fact, it was one of the things that led to the cleavage between mathematics and physics. That is, that the mathematicians were studying the actual motions of the planets, whereas the physicists were making theories like the Aristotelian theory about homocentric spheres. And without being over-worried about the fact that their theories didn't fit the observations. You simply cannot. Unfortunately, a lot of people are confused about this. When I started to learn general relativity, a lot of the books on general relativity that I was reading tried to explain it in terms of the mathematics of curved space-time. And that's not the underlying physical principle. There is an underlying physical principle, the equivalence of gravity and inertia, which then can be formulated in terms of curved space-time. But you cannot defend, for example, the appearance of the curvature tensor in Einstein's equations by saying that that's what expresses the curvature of space-time. Mm-hmm. It has to be defended on other grounds. At bottom, the principle of equivalence of gravity and inertia. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote my book on gravitation in 1972, that was the point of view I emphasized. So science is not a branch of mathematics, as many people throughout the centuries have thought it was. Mm-hmm. And you cannot learn about the world just by doing mathematics or abstract thinking, although it certainly helps a lot to be able to do those things. But now about rigor, which you asked me about, it's hard to be rigorous and in mathematics. And part of, it seems to me, the equipment of a physicist is to know at every point what degree of rigor is required. And the answer is not perfect mathematical rigor at all times, because then you'll never get any physics done. And after all, when you're exploring a new area and trying to make theories about phenomena, if you worried about the rigorous formulation of those theories, you'd really be wasting your time, because you don't even know if those theories have anything to do with nature. It is every once in a while one discovers that something that was passed over as a mere point of mathematical principle is really important. Mm-hmm. It's very rare. Mm-hmm. I don't think, for example, that the development of the standard model of cosmology or the standard model of elementary particles received any great benefit from people who were trying to make those theories mathematically rigorous. There is a rigorous approach to quantum field theory, which was pushed by Arthur Whiteman and Arthur Jaffe and so on, and they did some beautiful work, and it's really very reassuring to know that some of the things we were taking for granted can be rigorously proved using that mathematical apparatus. But I don't think we really needed to know that. It's nice to know it. But, I mean, for example, there's the TCP theorem.
Yes.
Very important result. In my own book on quantum field theory, I prove it using perturbation theory in a thoroughly non-rigorous way. But I think in a way that gives the reader a sense of why it's true that there is this symmetry. Whiteman and Streeter wrote a book called, TCP something and all that. And that's very nice. And I'm glad someone's doing that. But I don't feel we needed that in order to believe in the TCP theorem. Mm-hmm. It's just like in anything else. You know, if you, if you're a general, you receive intelligence from a number of different sources. And at a certain point, you have to decide what you think the dispositions of the enemy really is. And you can't be certain. You're never certain. And it's part of the intellectual equipment of a good general that you know when to finally stop receiving intelligence reports and make up your mind.
I like that analogy. I do like that.
I read a lot of military.
Now history. I know Freeman Dyson's always telling me you should have been a historian as well as a physicist. So.
No, I'm not a historian. I'm enough of a history buff to know that there's a big gulf between me and real historians. But I'm, if anything, I'm like a history buff. Mm. But I do like history, and I write about it sometimes because I think I have something of my own to add, which is the perspective of a working scientist today. Mm. I once asked professional historian was complaining about amateur historians writing history. And I asked him, suppose you wanted to write a history of shoemaking. You could have it written by a historian who really can probe the historical sources that describe the evolution of shoemaking. Or you could have it written by a shoemaker who isn't as well equipped to probe those historical sources and probably doesn't even realize that they exist, but still has a personal experience of making shoes. And who would you ask to write the history? And he gave what I thought was the perfect answer, which is both. And so I'm the shoemaker, but I get tremendous benefit from the real historians when they write.
I asked Weinberg whether he's ever been inspired by mathematics.
Mathematics is just so beautiful that many times in my life, in fact, you know, I had a very conventional mathematical education at Cornell and almost none in graduate school. What we mostly learned was analysis, that is, complex variables, special functions, and things like that. We learned essentially no group theory and certainly no topology.
Group theory is about the mathematics of symmetries, and topology is about the properties of things that remain the same when they're stretched, twisted, or deformed, but not torn.
Since getting my graduate degree, I've had to educate myself in group theory and topology, and I keep finding things that blow my mind.
Really?
I mean, for example, learning that there was a catalog of all simple Lie groups, and we knew what they all were. Learning that there was a deep relation between the topologies of manifolds and the kinds of solutions of certain differential equations.
Oh, she's T.S. Singer.
No, well, not even that. I was thinking of Durham cohomology. So then T.S. Singer, when it came to actual applications in index theorems, in quantum field theory, there are things that I've learned that I always wish I could have found some physics application for, but couldn't. Some physicists, I think, have been so much in love with the mathematics that they struggle to find a physics context in which the mathematics is relevant. For example, there's this great classification of all division algebras, real numbers, complex numbers, quaternions and octonions. And I know physicists who spent many hours trying to find a physical application for that, and it hasn't worked, really. When beautiful mathematics comes together with physics, it's really very exciting. But I don't think, although I've fallen in love with branches of mathematics, I can't think that any of my own research has been inspired by that.
That's what I thought. I don't have a perfect knowledge, of course, of your research, but I couldn't think of an example
I don't think so. The hardest mathematics I ever did...
renormalization
Yes,
group.
Exactly. Yeah. No, not the renormalization group, but the proof that what Dyson and Salam had done in isolating ultraviolet divergences actually made the intervals converge. I spent a year doing very hard mathematics to prove that, and I even used something I had learned in a course on rigorous mathematics, the Heine-Borel theorem. I think it may be the only use of the Heine-Borel theorem in physics. And I was very proud of that, but I never wanted to do that again.
Why?
Well, it just took too much time to prove with certainty something that everyone took for granted anyway.
That may be, maybe your attitude's a scar. Maybe it's a scar on...
Well, possibly, yes. Yeah. I mean, one has limited time and energy,
course,
and you have to judge what it's worth doing it for. And usually, for me at least, mathematical rigor is not the answer.
I wanted to pursue the theme of the relationship between mathematics and physics. The mathematical physicist Freeman Dyson and the mathematician Michael Atiyah had emphasized to me that after the Second World War, researchers in pure mathematics and researchers in fundamental physics had rather lost interest in each other's company and gone their separate ways. The two subjects had, in that sense, divorced. Did Weinberg agree with that view?
Well, I don't see that a divorce took place in 1945. There had been a divorce, as I said earlier, for centuries from the time of Plato until the Scientific Revolution. Mathematicians were supposed to concern themselves with the quantitative description of appearances, and scientists were supposed to understand in a non-quantitative way the nature of things, the reason for things. You know, Aristotle characteristically divorced himself from mathematics. He gave very good arguments for the fact that the Earth is curved, observing that the appearance of the heavens changes when you when a traveler goes north or south, but made no effort to use the data that he was quoting, which was not quantitative but just casual observation, to make an estimate of the size of the Earth. There was a divorce between mathematics and science, which meant that science, during this long period until the scientific revolution, what people called, say, physics, was largely impotent to develop theories that could be critically tested, since nothing was ever quantitative. That divorce was healed in the scientific revolution by mathematically gifted astronomers like Newton and Kepler, and mathematics continued to be deeply involved with science, especially after Newton, with the great French mathematicians Laplace, D'Alembert, and so on, who went way beyond Newton in applying Newton's theory to observation. And in fact, did some calculations correctly that Newton had screwed up, like the calculation of the precession of perihelia, which Newton had made a mess of, and D'Alembert got right. Yeah, I would add Clairaut as another key name. And of course, physics goes on being deeply involved with mathematics. If there's any divorce, you might say it may be that Dyson was referring to a divorce between rigorous mathematics and physics, but I don't know that rigorous mathematics was ever that crucial in physics. I mean, for example, I don't think that Maxwell was very much concerned with mathematical rigor in developing his theory of electromagnetism, and certainly Faraday wasn't mathematically trained at all. I mean, Max Planck, in developing his theory of black body radiation, first simply guessed at a formula that would fit the data, and then he gave a derivation of that formula using thermodynamics, which is so woolly it's really hard to understand. I think since the scientific revolution, scientists have generally understood pretty well what level of mathematical rigor is needed in different problems. And I don't think that 1945 represented any kind of turning point. Dyson may be referring to the fact that through his own work in 1949, physicists became comfortable with living with theories that produced infinite quantities, as long as there was a way of reinterpreting what you meant by the mass of the electron or the charge of the electron in such a way that the infinities would cancel. And being willing to live with a theory in which infinities occur, but in which they cancel, is certainly a sign of a high tolerance for a lack of rigor. But I don't think that was anything new. So I don't understand Dyson's remark, and I don't understand. I don't understand Atiyah's agreement with it, except Atiyah, being a real mathematician, may identify mathematics with rigorous mathematics. But then I don't see why he thinks that there ever was much of a joining of rigorous mathematics and natural science. I mean, certainly Newton wasn't doing rigorous mathematics, and maybe Laplace was, but I mean, there was that rigorous school of mathematics due to Cauchy and others. Perhaps Laplace was was following in that standard, but not many creative physicists were.
Okay. May I send you a copy of Freeman's paper on that?
Absolutely. I'd love to see it.
Okay.
I love reading Freeman, and I often disagree, but I never fail to be stimulated. Yeah.
Several months after this interview, I asked Freeman Dyson and Michael Atiyah whether they stood by their statement about the post-war divorce between mathematics and physics. They did, and emphasised that they were talking specifically about two communities: researchers at the frontiers of pure mathematics and researchers at the frontiers of theoretical physics. I moved on to ask Weinberg what he thought about another comment, this time from the philosopher of science Ian Hacking. He's pointed out what at first looks like a surprising quote from Weinberg, to the effect that Weinberg and his colleagues began to look in the 1950s at symmetries in particle physics, quote, for want of anything better to do, unquote. What did Weinberg mean by that?
The 1950s was a period in which experiment had gotten way ahead of theory. We had a tremendous amount of data about strong forces, in particular what we now call hadronic physics. Mm-hmm. We had new strongly interacting particles, hadrons being discovered all the time.
Yep.
And because the forces were strong, it was generally understood that the kind of perturbation theory that had worked so well for electrodynamics in the 1940s in quantum electrodynamics could not possibly be relied on.
Freeman Dyson commented in the early 1970s that he believed it would take a century for physicists to understand the strong force. That understanding arrived, however, in only a few years. Weinberg hadn't heard that story, but...
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he had said it. I would say, though, if he had said it in the 50s or the 60s, it would not be an absurd thing to say.
No.
There was a general sense of hopelessness about understanding the strong forces. And much the same, well, not the same, but in parallel, you could say similar things about the weak and electromagnetic, the weak forces. We had a phenomenological theory going back to Fermi's theory of beta decay, which clearly gave nonsense when pushed beyond the lowest order of perturbation theory, in a way that you had infinities that couldn't be dealt with by renormalization, as they are dealt with in quantum electrodynamics. Mm-hmm. And the amount of data was not very great. It was mostly data about nuclear beta decay, with a certain small amount of data about decays of elementary particles or hadrons. Mm-hmm. And the problem there was not that the forces were so strong, but that we had no theory that made mathematical sense at all. With the strong interactions, we could write down any number of theories that would be renormalizable, would be free of the problem of infinities, like, for example, the old pseudoscalar meson theory. But you couldn't use them, and none of them had any rationale. They were all just guesswork, and none of them could be used to make predictions because the forces were too strong. It was almost a mirror image of that situation in the theory of weak forces. We knew the forces were weak, so that first-order perturbation theory made sense, and we had a theory that worked in first-order perturbation theory, the generalization of Fermi's theory of beta decay, but the theory we knew made no sense when pushed beyond the first-order of perturbation theory. So there was also a sense of hopelessness about the weak interactions, but there again we could make progress in studying their symmetry properties. There was the great discovery in 1957 that certain symmetries, which are valid symmetries of the strong and the electromagnetic forces, are not valid symmetries of the weak force. I'm thinking particularly of parity and charge conjugation invariance. And So a great deal of work was being put into seeing what other symmetries are not respected by the weak interactions. And it was found, for example, that time reversal invariance and CP invariance were not. That was the sort of thing you could usefully do in those days. You could also pin down the details of Fermi's theory.
Our modern understanding of the strong force arrived in the form of a gauge theory known as quantum chromodynamics, part of the standard model of particle physics. I was eager to hear from Weinberg what it felt like to see that theory take shape.
Our standard model, which we're so proud of, although we're also discontented with it, was developed in the 60s and 70s, with the final step being the development of quantum chromodynamics. And it completely changed the spirit of elementary particle physics. I mean, we were no longer rooting around looking for odds and ends that we might do. I mean, we now had a theory.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like Newton. Suddenly you had a theory that would allow you to calculate anything you wanted to calculate. You want to know the precession of the ellipse of the planets? That had been observed by Muslim astronomers in Spain, that the Earth's orbit, well, they put it in terms of the sun's orbit around the Earth precesses.
Mm-hmm.
And Copernicus, we would say the Earth's orbit around the sun precesses. This is an effect of mostly of the interaction with other planets.
Mm-hmm.
That could be calculated suddenly. Mm-hmm. And of course, the calculation worked except there was a small discrepancy for Mercury, which turned out to have
slight consequences.
<Yeah. laughs>
Tell me, when did you said suddenly, now I don't want to be too literal-minded, but could you say roughly when you thought that was?
Well, I think for different people understood things at different times. For me, and I could only answer personally, I gave a talk at a conference, I think it was a European physics conference at Aix-en-Provence in 73 or 74, and I laid it out that we now understood elementary particles, and that was really new to a lot of the people in the audience.
Really?
That there was a tendency to feel that, you know, this is theory, but, you know, to what extent can you really believe in it? By that time, there had been evidence for some time before that the strong interactions become weak at high energy, and the quantum chromodynamics explained it. And also the neutral currents had just been discovered.
Neutral currents are interactions mediated by the so-called Z or Z particle. It's predicted by the gauge theory of the weak interaction to be the heavy cousin of the familiar photon.
It's not only that neutral currents were discovered, because after all people had speculated about neutral currents since the 30s, but they fit the theory.
At the Gargamel.
Yeah, and but even more of the neutrino experiments at studying deep inelastic neutrino scattering at CERN. And I felt the game was over. You know, we hadn't at that point discovered the W and the Z. And there was the experimental quantitative tests of quantum chromodynamics had not been worked out. You know, the fact that in electron positron annihilation you get jets, and that the distribution of those jets in angle fits exactly what you expect from quantum chromodynamics, that hadn't been done yet. But to me it was like what a physicist would feel after Newton, that sure, we haven't done all the calculations and we haven't checked everything, but this is clearly the
right
answer. That was for me right after the discovery of neutral currents, and I remember giving that talk because I felt I was really opening up something to the audience that they hadn't realized. I wasn't the only one. Most of us at Harvard were. I mean, you know, there was a group at Harvard of Glashow, Georgie, Coleman.
Yeah.
We all knew what was going on.
Yeah, I know. So when was the November Revolution? That was November 1974.
Oh, you mean the discovery of the charm particle? Yeah. This was before.
So this was before that?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I think you were way ahead of the game then.
Well, I'm not 100%. I should try to look back and see when that
was.
Well,
I can tell you, I've been a graduate student 20 days. So I thought physics was always one big party, you know?
Well, you know, the physicists now, the really smart theoretical physicists are working at the outer boundaries of modern mathematics. They've long ago left my expertise behind. But
in mathematics?
Yeah, in mathematics, that's right. that's what I mean. And but they have not had that wonderful experience of having theories being verified by experiments. And, of course, it wasn't that simple. It never is. The electroweak theory was contradicted by experiments also.
Mm.
And it took a few years to find that the experiments were wrong. I'm talking particularly about the failure to find parity violation in atomic physics. In fact, I remember I was interviewed on the BBC by Nigel Calder?
Yeah.
Was Nigel Calder.
Yeah,
and right. I gave a glowing talk about how we understand this and we understand this and so on. And then he said, yes, but there are these experiments on parity violation in atoms, and they're not finding the parity violation. And I said, well, I started to excuse it. And of course, I didn't have the intellectual courage. And in fact, I didn't even think that the experiments could be so totally wrong. I thought there was something wrong in the theoretical interpretation of these. But the experiments were simply wrong.
I remember when they were got right. I remember the...
As a matter of fact, there was a Russian experiment in Novosibirsk which got the right answer, and none of us believed it because at that point, Russian experimental physics did not have a very good reputation. We thought they were just working hard to get in a result that agreed with theory.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, we were wrong. They had really done it right and gotten the right answer, and we didn't take that seriously enough.
That's quite a good one for some of the more skeptical philosophers of science who seem to think that physicists, we tune things up to agree with experiments.
Yeah, well, you know, I've said about that there's a tendency to rate prediction much higher than retrodiction or postdiction because you're afraid that the theorists, knowing the experimental data, will fine-tune his theory to make it fit the experiment. And so the experiment doesn't really confirm the theory. But in fact, the real danger is just the opposite. It's that the experimentalist, knowing the theory, will keep looking for corrections until the data fit the experiment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So very often a retrodiction is more decisive than a prediction, and I gave the example of the calculation of the precession of the perihelion of Mercury was actually a much more decisive test of general relativity, even though the data was already well known, and in fact the anomaly, the fact that it didn't fit Newtonian calculations was already well known. That was a much more convincing test of general relativity than the famous 1919 eclipse expedition, which observed the deflection of light by the sun. And in fact, people have argued ever since whether or not there was some fudging going on that. I don't have an opinion of my own, but I heard a talk at the Royal Astronomical Society once by someone who said that their results could not have been as accurate as they claimed.
Yeah, I've heard that,
Well, in the end, it turned out that Einstein was right in both camps, but it was certainly the eclipse expedition that made him a world celebrity, and whereas he had already, it seems to me, been validated by the precession of Mercury.
When I was a graduate student of particle physics in the mid-1970s, it seemed to me that the theory of subatomic particles was becoming distinctly more mathematical. Likewise, the use of a brilliant mathematical theorem discovered by Michael Atiyah and Isidore Singer helped experts to understand a puzzling aspect of the theory, known to them as anomalies. Particle physics seemed to be acquiring a deep mathematical richness. Does Weinberg agree?
It certainly is true that one thing we learned, I mean, in fact, this is possibly the best example I know, that where you discover that what seemed to you an obvious way of mathematically exploiting a theory, namely perturbation theory, is not in fact adequate. That even when the forces are weak, there are phenomena that go beyond perturbation theory. That was quite quite an eye-opener for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of the people who pioneered that.
Theoretical physicists at that time were having to retool, learning mathematics that had long seemed to be completely irrelevant. Later, Weinberg had to include this mathematics in his classic three-volume textbook on quantum field theory.
That's true, and I had to learn topology. In fact, this book has an awful lot of topology in it, which are all things I learned in real time, yeah. as it were. As these things were happening, I had to learn the topology. The homotopy groups in particular, I remember, I had to learn a lot about. And there is another example of the beautiful connection between different branches of mathematics. The fact that you can characterize the topology of a manifold in terms of groups, the homotopy groups, and they are crucial in understanding the physical significance of things like instantons. All that was new to me, and it certainly led me to a richer view of what mathematics can do. But I never thought of it in terms of becoming more rigorous.
How times have changed since those days in the 1970s.
Do you think that's a good thing?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, anything that allows you to make progress is good. I think it's not good if the mathematics begins to dominate too much over physics, in the sense that people spend their time learning mathematics even when there's no connection to physics. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't put that to the charge of mathematics being a beautiful temptress. We have a good theory, and it's tested, and it goes on being tested. We, because of the discovery of the Higgs boson, we have a number that we didn't know before, the one number that we didn't know in the standard model, the mass of the Higgs. But it looks so much like an ordinary Higgs boson, just exactly what was predicted in the electroweak theory, that we're not getting any insight as to what to do next. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say this about cosmology. Cosmology is in a very exciting phase where new observations are being made that and we're actually beginning to understand inflation quantitatively. Well, it depends. If this experiment yes. that found the...
dust experiment.
Yeah, the Bicep 2 experiment. If that holds up, that will really mark a new plateau of excitement. Mm-hmm. But elementary particle physics is not in that state. We hope it will be. We hope that the Large Hadron Collider will discover something that we haven't anticipated. But mm-hmm. so far, it's just done a beautiful job of confirming the standard model. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know what I would do if I was starting physics now. For the last year or so, I've succumbed to a sort of perversion of old age, thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics.
You've done that before.
Yeah, occasionally. I'm doing it a little bit more.
You spent a year on it. You told me. Once about
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
But now I don't see what there is for me to do anyway. And I mean, a year ago I wrote two papers on elementary particle physics, one on hadronic physics, and the other on a kind of particle that might account for certain observations in the microwave background. Mm-hmm. And I thought they were both pretty good, innovative papers, and I was proud of both of them. Mm-hmm. One of them was quite speculative. The other was just debunking what had been generally thought in hadronic physics, namely that a certain approximation can't account for exotic hadrons where you might have two quarks and two antiquarks.
Oh, yeah.
And so I felt really in the swim in 2013. mm-hmm. But since then, I've only been thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics, mostly faute de mieux. That is, because I haven't had any good ideas on real elementary particle physics mm-hmm. since then. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, I go back and forth between one thing and another. I'm kind of an amateur in every area of physical science.
You don't realise how depressing that is for many people to hear that. you're not an amateur.
Well, I keep having to discover that the latest thing I've done has been already done by someone else, which is the sure sign of being an amateur. But I've had that experience so many times in my life. I first had that experience when I had a summer job in the atomic beam laboratory at Princeton. I figured out a technique of using matrix algebra to analyze the passage of atomic beams through an array of magnets, mm-hmm. where each magnet was associated with a certain matrix, mm-hmm. and you could move the magnets around just by multiplying the matrices in different order, mm-hmm. and find out what would happen to the beam. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a wonderful little bit of formalism of practical value, mm-hmm. and I was all excited by how smart I was. And then in the Princeton University bookshop, I saw a book with the title Matrix Calculation of Optical Instruments. And I didn't even have to open the book. I knew that was exactly what I had done. But this has happened to me again and again. And the only way to avoid it is not to do anything.
But I must take you for one thing, though. You know, with this vast industry of all these people doing all these ever more complex M theories and what have you, you know, these guys are working their butts off, you know, and then they'll say, it's a slow time for theoretical physics.
Well, I don't mean that people aren't working. It's a slow time for getting anywhere. I mean, all this work isn't producing anything that leads to... Well, you know, we've been talking about string theory, and I'm a fan of string theory. I even worked in string theory and gave a course on string theory in the late 80s. But we still don't know what string theory really is. Mm-hmm. What the word string theory refers to an approximation to a fundamental theory that we don't know, which describes it in terms of strings. As Witten has shown, there are a number of different theories, some of which are field theories, some of which are string theories, all of which exhibit properties that make you feel that they're all approximations to one fundamental theory, yep. but we don't know what that fundamental theory is. Mm-hmm. It's a very frustrating business, and if we did know, we wouldn't know how to do calculations that could be compared with observation. And it may be, in fact, that the lesson of string theory is that a lot of things that we thought we might calculate, we never will, because they're just environmental parameters describing our particular solution of string theory in a multiverse of solutions. We now know that there is a vast number of solutions of string theory.
The landscape.
Yeah, the landscape, right. And we don't really know whether they are all populated in some sense so that we have a multiverse of different kinds of universe. But if we do, then there are a lot of things that we had hoped to calculate that we never will calculate, just as Kepler at one point had hoped to calculate the distances of the planets from the sun, mm-hmm. and we now know you never will, because that's just an accident.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it may be that a lot of the things like the fine structure constant or the mass of the electron, we'll never be able to calculate them. They may just be accidents of the particular part of the multiverse we live in. Mm-hmm. Very depressing result. If we knew it was true, at least that would be interesting, but we don't even know that that's true. It may not be true. I think what we really need is for some new particle or force to be discovered at the LHC, either that hadn't been anticipated at all, or that opened up an area that had been anticipated, but which so far has been purely conjectural, like supersymmetry.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that would help more than to start discovering some superparticles at the LHC.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And so far they haven't. And in fact, because the Higgs mass is rather high, it sort of is a counterindication against low-energy supersymmetry. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, the Higgs boson, if you take supersymmetry just in the lowest order of perturbation theory, you would predict that the Higgs should be lighter than the Z. Mm-hmm. It isn't.
Z? I never thought I heard an American call that particle.
Well, I'm talking to an Englishman.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
I wouldn't.
It's the first time I've heard that word in 10 days, but Anyway, sorry, please carry on about supersymmetry.
Yeah, well, the Higgs is not lighter than the Z. That can be accounted for by radiative corrections, but it's hard for the radiative corrections to push the Higgs up as high as it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so some people are getting discouraged about supersymmetry. I think now the LHC is going to be turned on again, and we'll see. Maybe it will get us. We need a kick in the pants from new data, and that may be provided by the LHC, but it hasn't been so far. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a slow period. In fact, it really bothers me. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, because after all, the standard model was essentially in its present form in the 70s being completed by quantum chromodynamics. And then, as you said, the richness of its consequences were not well understood until the late 70s and the early 80s. But since, let's say, the mid-80s, we've had the standard model. The W and the Z were discovered in 84. We have no doubt about the correctness of the theory, although only as an approximation to some more fundamental theory, as indeed all physical theories are. But we haven't had anything that pushes us beyond the standard model in the way of experiment since the mid-80s. And there are people who are now quite well along in their physics career who've never had that experience of exciting new data. And many of particle physicists have gone into cosmology because it is in that stage where there's exciting new data that is relevant to theory, and there are theories that say things that are relevant to observation. Cosmology is in a state now like elementary particle physics, let's say in the 80s, when we had a standard model, but a lot of things were not pinned down.
It seems to me that most of the leading young theoretical physicists today don't share Weinberg's unhappiness about the state of their subject. How does he feel about that?
I don't at all blame them. I don't think they're making a mistake in the way they're carrying on their career. They're becoming very deep mathematically and will be in a good position if new observations produce theories in which that kind of mathematics is relevant, and then all us old geezers will envy them. But it's not clear that that's going to happen. And I think the fundamental principle of progress in science is you have to keep working. And if that's the only kind way they can keep working, then that's the right thing for them to do.
Weinberg is not hostile to mathematicians, even if he's sometimes critical of their apparent lack of interest in making themselves understood outside their own community. Although most of them pursue their research with no thought of any relevance their findings might have to the real world, it sometimes turns out that even abstruse results are useful or even essential to physicists. And it's physics that Weinberg really cares about.
Then there is some mathematics that's just done for purely mathematical purposes that turns out to be relevant to physics, like group theory itself. And that was done because of the study of solutions of polynomial equations, but turned out to be very useful. Differential geometry was done for purely geometrical reasons, and it turned out to be valuable to Einstein. There are lots of examples of mathematics that's done by mathematicians that turns out to be valuable to physicists. And perhaps that's what they're doing. Perhaps the young theoretical physicists today are building up a storehouse of mathematics that will turn out to be tremendously valuable to some future physicists, the way differential geometry turned out to be valuable to Einstein. But that hasn't happened yet. And I can't see it coming out of the mathematical work. In fact, that's a good point I should make.
Yeah.
It was not the mathematicians who developed group theory in the 19th century, like Sophus Lee and so on, who found the physical applications to elementary particle physics. And it was not the differential geometers like Riemann and Ritchie and all those who developed the application to general relativity. Mm. General relativity was developed by Einstein on the basis of deep physical intuitions and experience with observations, in particular the amazing fact that the gravitational inertial mass are equal. Mm-hmm. And general relativity grew out of that, and then he found the mathematics to hand. Mm-hmm. I really doubt that, and I don't know of any example where the development of the mathematics then by the mathematicians who developed it led to new physical theories. But it was a physicist, and certainly not a mathematician, who saw the use of differential geometry.
Yep.
So that it may be that something will happen in physics that gets us started in some direction, and all the mathematics that's being developed will turn out to be tremendously useful, but I suspect it won't be done by the people who are developing the mathematics. Mm-hmm. Ed Witten is a kind of exception because he is not only very deep mathematically, but he also is a very good physicist. And I'm not confusing the two. He has very good physical intuition. I co-authored one paper with him, and it's a paper that says that, well, essentially that there can't be any particles of mass zero and spin higher than two arising in quantum field theories. Mm-hmm. And I would say that if you had to characterize the contribution each of us made, his contribution was more on the side of physical insight.
In that paper?
Yeah.
What was yours then?
It was more working out the mathematics. It was kind of a role reverse. I love that paper because I usually, in the rare occasions when I collaborate, I usually insist on naming the authors alphabetically, and which means I'm never first. But in that paper, I was first.
One of the topics I cover in my book is the rapid change in the complexion of theoretical physics in the 70s and 80s. When surprising new experimental observations had all but dried up, the subject became much more mathematical. When I started out in the subject, it was a wonderful thing to see Weinberg and his peers complete the Standard Model. It was a golden period for particle physics. It's not surprising that Weinberg's troubled by the state of the subject today. But as we've heard, he doesn't think that his successors at the frontiers of research are doing anything wrong, though in my view, he's right to signal a concern that theoreticians could become seduced by, as he puts it, the mathematical temptress. As I say in the epilogue to The Universe Speaks in Numbers, I believe that in future, theoretical physicists are going to have to get used to long periods when observations and experimental results don't throw up any crucial new clues. This would mean that we'll see long periods in which theoretical physics is dominated by experts like Edward Witten, who excel at developing the mathematical content of theories that are grounded in the best available data that we already have. It's worth remembering that this is possible only because the universe speaks to us not only through the observations we make on it, but also through mathematics.